What does food freedom mean? What does liberty mean? For some, food freedom is growing and eating your own foods. Food liberty might mean you choose the foods you wish to eat, and for others, it might mean never wanting for a meal again. I define food liberty, food freedom, as eating what you grow or eating what you trade with your neighbors who grows something else. Food liberty requires no agencies or bureaucracies or overlords opining that you may not eat the fruits of your labor. And when you have an abundance and the neighbors are all set, they got plenty of tomatoes and corn, you process the rest in canning. Today's episode is about canning your bounty and the freedoms that we can find between the seams of the regulations. So sit back, grab a cuppa, and hang out. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 69.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. Surf your web browser over to culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts for all the shows, show notes, page links to catch up on previous episodes. Your help supporting the show is appreciated, and you can do that by clicking the banners to Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom and McClanahan Academy. Both sites are membership sites for history. Both sites add courses as they are prepared, so there is always more to learn. Liberty Classroom also has courses on politics and economics and Western civilization. My seventh graders' social studies class is starting the Greek civilization portion of their book. You can be sure I'll be filling in the gaps with the Western Civilization to 1500 course from Liberty Classroom. Both Liberty Classroom and McClanahan Academy courses are short enough to listen in the car, on the way to work, or on the way home, and while preparing dinner. Click through those links to see the courses offered and subscribe today. One other way to support the show is to rate and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. And in addition to the podcatchers currently carrying the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, I am happy to announce the show is now part of the Cerberus Radio Network. I'll post the link to that on today's show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/69. My guest today is Suzanne Sherman. Suzanne is a licensed attorney who quit her practice to raise her children. In 2013, she left home, California, to enjoy the peace and freedoms available in a remote location in the mountains of northeastern Utah. She makes radio appearances, hosts a show, and speaks on the principles of federalism, history, and liberty. Hello, Suzanne. Good morning. Thank you for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
I'm delighted to be here, Dan. Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. Before we get going into our topics for today, let's do just a quick introduction of who you are, what you do, and why liberty is important.
Well, I grew up in California, and I developed the preparedness lifestyle there once I became a mom, because we have to become prepared for, you know, earthquakes. So once I started learning and becoming more prepared, I started becoming more aware of politics as well, and realized that all is not what it seems. And when the very entity that you depend on for the truth, you realize you've been lied to, that for me fostered a sense in preparedness, which where this ties in with you and liberty. I decided to start growing my food, storing my food, because if you combine the two that I just mentioned, one of the first things we think about when it comes to be self-reliant and prepared, food, water, and shelter. So today we'll be talking about food.
Indeed. So we're going to talk about a few issues, and somehow they get intertwined, and that's okay. So let's start off with canning. And for some people, that's the food they grow and they pick and they put it up for the wintertime. It could be making jerky, and I know you're a hunter, but it's also the freedom to grow and eat your own food. Now, that last part actually is a for real book, and it could be more, but maybe we'll get into that part. But let's start with the basics of canning. For people interested and don't know where to start, they don't know what to do, how can people get started in canning food for their own home?
I think the first thing we have to do is overcome the myth that it is a lot of work or somehow it's unsafe to do. And it's really become a lost art. You know, you think about maybe watching an episode of The Waltons, you know, when they were putting up food and preserving food. And after the people recovered from the Great Depression, I think that this was a skill that was no longer valued. And I'm encouraged to see a lot of people are now taking up what I consider, again, this lost art. And there are a couple ways you can or preserve your own food. And the two ways are either by pressure canning or what they call a hot water bath method. And which one you use is determinative upon what exactly you are processing. So, you know, you had mentioned earlier about growing your own food, and that's really what got me started. I started growing tomatoes when I had a garden in California, and the crop was so prolific. I was freezing everything, making all sorts of stocks and salsas, that sort of thing. And eventually your freezer only has so much room. So I started learning how to preserve my food other ways. You can dehydrate. We'll do that on another show. But for canning, I started canning my produce when I lived out there. And for tomatoes, I use the pressure canning method because low acid fruits, you can either do them in a hot water bath and you have to add citric acid and adhere to the measurements properly. I like to do pressure canning. It takes any of the guesswork out of whether or not you have properly sterilized and gone through those methods. Because, you know, if you're going to do this for survival and you come across a time when maybe medical help might not be as available, that is not the time you want to deal with issues such as botulism or other pathogens and foodborne illnesses.
Well, there's never a time you want to deal with those, but certainly not then. And that's actually a valid concern, and that's always been a valid concern. And I remember many years ago in several places, but in Michigan, a restaurant brought in to serve some home canned things, but they weren't canned properly, and dozens of people went to the hospital with low grade botulism. Because this person didn't process the food properly and didn't know that she didn't process the food properly and then served it. So there are legitimate concerns that we need to make sure we take care of. So you and I were having a conversation a couple of days ago talking about cross-contamination. So let's just make sure we hit the point about working clean and how do we avoid... How do we minimize risk to begin with by working clean and not contaminating the foods?
Yeah, you always want to start with a clean workspace, clean hands. And if you do get your hands dirty, you know, I work with a lot of raw meat, and we can talk about this also because I do can much of my wild game. You know, when you're cutting this and then let's say, oh, you know what? The phone rings, you answer your phone, or you have to turn on the faucet or open a cabinet to get to the garbage or trash compactor. Remember everything you've touched. If you're not going to wash your hands every time, then go ahead and sanitize everything afterwards. Because again, a few shortcuts and carelessness can make a huge difference with regards to your canning equipment. When I pressure can, I put my jars through the dishwasher on a high heat cycle and then wash the lids in very hot soapy water. They call for sanitization of the jars and everything else in hot water bath, which is why I'm not such a huge fan of that. I prefer to have everything sanitized in the pressure cooker. That seems to do the job well. then you don't have to worry about adding either lemon juice or other forms of citric acid to the mix. But it's very important, again, to be careful. Keep your hands clean. Also, a work surface. I like to work in a kitchen area. I have granite countertops, so I know there aren't going to be any little cuts in there. I can use that as my work surface, and then I can sanitize it. Do not use any sort of surface that has tile or grout, because you were not going to be able to get all the bacteria out of there.
Well, that's a good point. And even so, at home, I have a wood cutting board, but I actually use a nylon board for all of my proteins. The wood boards, one of them is exclusively for fruit. So when I'm cutting fruit for the kids for breakfast, the other one gets everything else, garlic and onions and whatever it is.
Yeah.
At least the apples don't taste like garlic, and the kids, no one wants that, but certainly not a kid. So.
Right. I have wood cutting boards that I do not ever put any kind of meat on. I know some people do. But again, I have different artificial kinds of cutting board material. Like you said, it's other synthetic forms that you can sanitize for meats and proteins. And by all means, when you're cooking them together, don't mix the raw meat with something else that doesn't need to be cooked as thoroughly.
Right. So here in the middle of winter, and I realize some places like Texas and Florida, they're looking out the window saying, oh, no, winter's in 4 days from now. but the rest of the place where we have snow on the ground and the ground is frozen, home canning, is there, this is something I don't know, is there something that can be done to prep for canning coming up since we don't have a garden? Is canning food from the grocery store a viable option? And what should we be aware of on the surface of the food in the grocery store versus the food that we've grown in our own backyard?
Absolutely. You know, I have been known, I don't like factory farms, that sort of thing, but that's a topic for a different show. But I have seen at Walmart where they've had 15-pound rolls of beef, 15 pounds of beef on sale for ridiculously low prices. And before I had, you know, wild game and I was learning how to can meat, I took advantage of that and I pressure canned it. I started by canning chicken, and I like to find food that is locally grown and locally processed. But if you're getting stuff from the store and you are going to pressure can it, such as meats, take advantage of the sales, because a lot of people that are trying to stock up on food just to save money are going to look for these prices. Take advantage of that. And if you can't possibly eat with your family 15 pounds of meat, have it on in a quart size canning jar and use it as you need it. Once you open the jar, then use it rather quickly before it goes bad. But absolutely, you can can stuff from the store. Take advantage of stuff that's on sale for sure.
Cool. Now, many years ago, as a kid, teen or something, my neighbor, she had down in her basement 1x4 pieces of wood on cinder blocks and made a dozen or so shelves. And on those shelves were hundreds of mason jars filled with just all kinds of things. Now, this is a real problem. I mean, not if you have the space, but someone who's going to get into canning, very quickly, the question is, where do I put this stuff? So can you think of a solution? How does one manage, I'm going to can all these things, but now what do? How do you fix this problem?
Well, I have a pantry that's dedicated to food and supply storage. And one little trick also, when I'm having a vision of those wooden shelves there, I actually installed my wire shelves upside down. So there was actually a lip that was facing up. So they can't slide off. So the downside to canning is the jars are fragile. They can break. They can have the seals, the vacuum seal released if you stack them on top of each other. So stacking them on top of each other is not advisable. They do take up space. They are heavy. So if you want to include them in a bug out bag or camping or something like that, that's not very advised. For that method, I would go more the freeze dried route. But, you know, they can be very cumbersome and they do take up space. But I would encourage somebody who is maybe feeling a little apprehensive because of the space, a significant amount of canning like I do takes, you'd be surprised how much space is available in your home. It's there if you want it. You can put it You know, people have storage units and totes under their beds or in their closets. It's amazing if you are serious about it, where you can put your canned goods. It is important, though, to keep them in a cool, dark place.
Okay. Well, the stacking part, I didn't know that, and I don't do that until it's opened and it's in the refrigerator, but that was that's an interesting piece of information.
Well, one thing I do is I'll keep the boxes that the canning jars come in, and I will put, some of them are on shelves, but because I do so much canning, particularly I make so much elk stock, I do keep those in their boxes, and I stack the boxes, but because there's a bottom, the weight is so evenly distributed, it's not going to, or it has not yet caused an issue. But again, always check, push up and down on the lid. If there's any give, throw it out. Don't eat it. Do not consume, because you're not going to be able to boil foodborne illnesses out of there safely. I would not want to risk botulism for something like that. So get rid of it and just stack them that way. And that's a great way to save space.
Well, that's a good tip. Let's move out of the kitchen a little bit and go into the garden. Now, I've done some blog posts and some podcasts about food freedom, and I mentioned that earlier. I think some people may not understand what food freedom means. And obviously it means growing your own food, but it's also, they may not know that there are jurisdictions where it has been, now this is another show, but judges have rendered the opinion that you do not have the right to consume the food from your garden. And any reasonable person who hears that is going to say, well, just stop a minute. That just doesn't make any sense. But this has happened a couple of times. And the really big one, and I've talked about this a lot, is raw milk. And that's a almost perennial issue about whether or not the farmer can, they seem to grant the farmer can drink the raw milk, but the farmer can't sell it to anybody to drink the raw milk. And somehow, this is just a level of stupid that's I don't understand. But let's come back to the good side of food freedom, which is the increasing cottage food movement in every state except New Jersey. And I don't know why New Jersey doesn't have this, which is that and every state's different, but to some level, the person, man or woman, you can make baked goods, and there are some rules about what you can and can't sell from your front door. You can advertise carefully on social media. You can go down to your food market or your flea market and sell stuff. So now that we take this idea of food freedom, I'm going to misapply a phrase a little bit, but I'm going for a point, this rugged individualism we're going to start a small business. And this is where we come into the idea of liberty. How does that apply to you where you are? I don't know that you're selling anything, but does your state prohibit you from eating legally the food you grow?
No, but we do have, we are allowed to consume raw milk if we purchase a share in a cow. I believe there's a place in Heber, a farm in Heber, which is about 30 minutes from me, where we can do that. As far as selling canned goods, I have never done that. I personally also would not purchase them or take them from somebody unless I knew them very well. So you mentioned a farmer's market or flea market. I would not purchase an item from somebody I didn't know. I would not get them at those sources. So if I know somebody, I will barter. I barter my elk stock. I barter a lot of my food, my canned elk or venison. I make all sorts of meals in the canning jars. I have no interest in selling them. I believe that they're better as a bartering tool. That's just my opinion. And also, I have to be leery because in the state of Utah, you mentioned our freedom to sell or use our food as we so desire. It is actually illegal to sell any of our game meat. It is even illegal to barter it, which I think is crazy.
Well, I agree with the crazy part. I know that I don't know all of the laws, but in Oregon, if I were to do cottage food here, some of the restrictions are on the class of foods called potentially hazardous foods, which would include anything with meat protein. So that's out. I couldn't serve you a steak. I couldn't sell you a piece of meat. But that also includes buttercream icing for a cake. So I could sell you the layers of cake and you got to go home and put the cake together, which sort of seems entirely against the whole idea. Also, I could probably sell you a donut, but it can't be filled with homemade pastry cream. It's got to be filled with something shelf stable, and which most donuts are. Most people don't know that what's in the donut, you probably don't really want to eat if you knew what was in there.
But or the donut itself, quite honestly.
Well, homemade donuts are really good.
And homemade,
yeah,
yes.
You know, just, I like.
Yeah.
They're pretty stinking yummy.
Now I want one. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, go on the blog, and there's actually, so one of the, when I was at a bakery in New Jersey, we did, you know, your standard ring donuts and a couple of filled donuts, and and they were all good. We made everything there. We ganached and the pastry cream, the whole nine yards. But what was missing was a chocolate yeast ring fried donut. You can get a chocolate baked donut, and baked donuts, they have their place, and I've got some recipes for that. But a chocolate fried yeast ring donut we didn't have it, so I set to inventing one, and I did.
Well, and I'll have to go look for that.
Well, it's on the blog. It is. Oh my! It's I take no responsibility or blame for what happens to you. But by the way, since you're looking at donuts, Punchki time is coming up, and I'm just going to mention that the end of February is Fat Tuesday. For all you Polacks, for real or otherwise, get your punchki on. Suzanne, while you consider how many dozen punchki to make, let's take a moment out for a word from my sponsor, Anchor.fm. Hey folks, if you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me tell you why. It's free. Free is good. They have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcasts right from your phone or your computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you, so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, CastBox, and many more. You can make money from your podcast with sponsors, just like this one, with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. And if you use your phone, you can be podcast on the spot, getting news and interesting things, whatever appeals to you, wherever you are. Download the free app to your phone or go to anchor.fm to get started creating your podcast today. You've listened to The World on Podcasts. Now go tell the world your story. Visit anchor.fm today to get started. Now let's get back into the show.
You know, when you talk about food and liberty here, it always raises a slippery slope question with me, because clearly we have an interest in knowing that there isn't some hack out there selling food that they have slovenly, you know, habits or practices, and it's going to be tainted, and we're going to have botulism and other issues. You know, I don't know where we draw the line where there is a legitimate form of government to protect the consumer from that or ourselves from that. But I would say the only way I could get around that would be know your sources and know the people that you want to purchase from or trade with.
Well, I think that's the first part, is starting with the community. So on my block, I actually know my neighbors.
Yes.
And I go to the houses. I take them. I give them little surprise booze at Halloween. And then at Christmas time, I show up and hand them the thing as a, like a little neighborly Christmas present. So I know who my neighbors are. And they know who we are. So I think the solution begins with going back to how people engaged each other, well, 100 years ago, but possibly 60 years ago, knowing who your neighbors are, knowing them on a first name basis, knowing who their kids are. It's kind of an extended family. It's your community. And so we can get into either Brian McClanahan's Think Locally, Act Locally. We can get very controversial into Hans Hermann Hoppe's, you know, community of your block. But controversy aside and jingoism aside and ideology aside, know who you live next to. I mean, really, seriously, know who your neighbors are. In your case, your neighbor might be 5 miles away, but know who your neighbors are.
Well, and exactly. I've gone over there and my neighbor, hey, would you like some moose meat? I don't like wild game. Sure, I'll take these. You know, think about a community. Remember in Florida, the state actually had to pass legislation prohibiting municipalities from in turn prohibiting front yard vegetable gardens. Imagine a community like that where you know your neighbors and everybody has a vegetable garden in their front yard or any kind of garden, herbs, fruits, whatever. And then people can share what they're growing. People can diversify their crops based on what their neighbors are growing. It's a tremendous liberty, I mean, there to have within your own community because you know your neighbors and are cooperating to have your grocery stores just right there in your front yards or back, wherever you decide to put them, because you know what? It's your damn property.
Well, it is. And so there's actually an argument to be made about it's the bank's property and you're paying for the privilege of having it, but that's another show.
That's another show.
So, well, you know, so having lived in Florida, and I know that different friends, one guy, and I mean, this was Naples, I think, had a massive, I mean, huge mango tree. And so when mangoes were in season, everybody had mangoes because he had so many he didn't know what to do with. Another fella had Meyer lemon trees and orange trees and lime trees. And they're just part – so they sell them as kind of – they're ornamental, but they're functional. They produce food. And no one complains about having a pretty citrus tree in the front yard, but now you're growing radishes and corn and romaine lettuce, and suddenly this is a problem. And the big argument, and I know the case you're talking about, they were complaining about the aesthetics mm-hmm. and property values. Well, your point is valid. Dum-dums, grow something that he's not and work together. So
you know what's coming to mind when you're talking about this? You know how people have those little libraries, take a book, leave a book? Imagine how cool it would be if people had these fruit trees or citrus trees or gardens in their yard. Take something, leave something. Have a basket by your front door. People want to pick a couple apples, they can leave you some tomatoes or zucchini or something like that. I just love the thought of a community like that. And I hope anybody that's listening that isn't in a community like this and they know their neighbors, you know, start this out, follow up with Dan and tell us what you're doing.
That's a great idea. And you just, the segues that happen. Years ago in Tallahassee, there was a fellow who had a little restaurant and he had, I don't know what happened to it, I mean, probably got run down by city problems. He had a genius idea, which was to take the spare medians space, and sometimes it might be 3 or 4 square feet of little lot of sand or grass between the sidewalks, and turn them into a community garden
mm-hmm.
for food. So we're going to, but it was a great idea. I think it took a lot more work, and I don't know what ended up happening to the idea, but I think that there's a lot of ways that a community can be built, and it really just starts with the community of two neighbors. You start that friendship, and then it grows. It doesn't happen rapidly. It takes time, but you know the interest in getting we talked before the show, the interest in getting away from commercial meat, and possibly even away from commercial produce, and finding local to you, maybe even a state away as opposed to an entire continent away, chicken or beef or, you know, someone who's got wild game and you got a barter, but getting more localized, going down to the flea market or finding the person who makes muffins and you're going to barter or flat out buy muffins from grandma down the street and someone else has bagels. Maybe the guy's a roofer and you need roofing. That who cares what it is? These kinds of things build the community, foster the liberty that we're talking about, and now this is the thing that people will hear and say, "This is insane. You're crazy. This won't happen." This is how you nullify the state.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not the nation state. The Washington D.C. is dead. Forget it. That's just a pit of viruses. But at your local community, get the roofer to come to your house and you trade. If he agrees to that, a voluntary exchange agreed upon by both parties, who has a dispute? And this is actual revolution. Doesn't require arms, all it requires is volunteer.
You know, this is so on point with what, and you and I did not discuss this before the show, this just magically fell into the conversation. The state of Utah just had an emergency tax reform bill signed into law when just before Christmas time, nobody was looking. It was right during the height of the impeachment distraction. Utah legislatures now impose this tax reform that included now a huge increase, not only in food tax, but in services. So you mentioned a roofer, dog groomers, estheticians, veterinarians, because their lobby is very strong, are magically excluded. So we're either going to have a service tax or we're not, right? Now we have crony favoritism. So here's the interesting thing, and we were just discussing this on my show the other day, the way to nullify this garbage outside the actually grassroots referendum that's going up to challenge this, the way to nullify this is trade amongst yourselves, sell amongst yourselves. When you're looking for somebody to provide a service for you or this food, hey, are you going to collect a tax? No. Hey, you're my guy. I'm going to use you. Nullify and ignore. You just mentioned consenting adults having to barter, trade, or otherwise deal with each other in a manner that benefits them both. It's none of the state's business. And this is how we nullify these kind of egregious laws.
I like the words. And I know that there are people who will be listening to this who will say, I also like the sound of that, but I'm not that brave. I can't do that.
Yeah. And I think somebody that has a license, like a nail salon or something like that, or a commercial roofer, they're going to be more under the eye. But you know, if somebody's a painter or can come to your house and do it one-on-one, you know, I would take a shot. But I agree, there could be penalties for it. And some people aren't brave enough to thumb their nose at the government. I do it every opportunity I get.
Well, it's a legitimate concern. If you have a business that is, you know, the state's looking at this, I mean, I don't fault them for being hesitant, because their livelihood is on the line, and the house and the food and the cars and the food for the kids. It's not an incidental thing. I don't mean to belittle their resistance. I think that that's an important observation, but I can't speak for them, but I don't know, because I don't have a business that requires a license. Maybe there's a way within the confines of those regulations that they can, I don't know.
I think it definitely has to be in the confines of people that are flying under the radar. I homeschooled my children, and they, you know, I did not do that with any state involvement in contravention to state laws, but because I kept quiet about this. So if people have a cottage industry, hey, I walk dogs. I'm not advertising. This is a service I do among friends. In fact, when I did have dogs, there was a lady that lived down in town that would watch people's dogs. Was she licensed? Was she a licensed kennel? Nope. I said, hey, do my dogs have to have their rabies certificates? She goes, you know, I work with responsible owners who I know takes good care of their dogs. So here is an example of, you know, people taking advantage of each other's abilities. She had an area where my dogs could go when I was on vacation, and nobody else was involved, just us.
Sweet. That's how it should be.
Yep.
Since this is the Culinary Libertarian Show, I'm going to move into the part of the show that is kind of the fun little short answer bit, modeled after a little bit the Inside the Actor's Studio. Now, if you've never seen the show, then that's okay. Of the five flavors, salty, sweet, bitter, sour, or umami, which one is your favorite?
Probably, unfortunately, salty.
There's nothing wrong with salt. What's your favorite food?
Oh, goodness. I have to say one of my favorite foods is elk that I have just killed. I love to take the loins out. I season them when they're warm and put them on the cast iron skillet. Love it. There's nothing better.
That's nice. I've had elk, but I've butchered head to tail venison, but never enough. That's a big beast.
It's a lot of work.
Do you tan the hides?
You know, that's something I want to do. I have a lot of friends that are bushcrafters, primitive survival experts, and they do it. For me, on my own, it's a lot to do. I have the hides. It's something I want to learn. But like I said, one hide can take you an entire day to work on just defleshing it. And I just don't have that kind of time available. But I make all the use out of all the meat. I take scraps and bones and the marrow, the connective and fascia tissue, and make elk stock out of it, which is full of chondroitin, glucosamine, collagen. And I use that throughout the year. I've been making soup with it, stews, chilies, you name it. So I use all of it, but I haven't done any tanning of the hides. In fact, I have 4 elk feet right now in the back of my side-by-side, and I'm going to skin those. And a friend of mine's going to donate some buckskin, and we're going to make purses out of them.
Nice.
So yeah, I'm utilizing it more and more. I know people that literally will make knives out of the scapula, and they make soap out of the hooves. So I'm learning to use more of it. So it's more than just canning. But, you know, for the purpose of this show, one thing I'll also do is when I'm butchering it is put it through a grinder and then grind it up and cook it like I would hamburger meat for any recipe, you know, lightly seasoned salt, pepper, and some onions. Then it's ready to go. I've made enchiladas with it. Anything that you would use ground beef for, it's ready to go. And it's one step that takes a lot of time out of the process. If you're coming home from work and don't want to put a lot of time in a meal, this is a step that is very time consuming that's already done for you.
What's your least favorite food?
Bananas. Hate them. Won't touch them.
What gets you excited?
Tacos. I mean, you know, for me, I think when it comes to food, the most exciting thing, I think, as much as I love those, I really do love harvesting my own game. And the most thing, or I guess what I really do like the most is providing food that I've either cultivated or harvested on my own. And it's, to me, a gift that you can give your loved ones.
That's nice. What turns you off?
Processed foods, Velveeta cheese, In-N-Out, not In-N-Out burgers, any fast food restaurant. I won't touch it. Haven't been to them for years. Sodas, anything like that.
What sound do you love?
My djembe drum.
What's a djembe drum?
It's an African style drum. Another sound I really love too is the, again, it's wintertime and the heart of the elk season is they're all around my canyon right now. Hearing them call each other back and forth is just amazing. And a lot of people don't get to hear that, particularly from the comfort of their own homes.
No, I think that's a rare thing indeed. What sound do you hate?
Oh, gosh. Why am I thinking of election cycles and politicians? You know, anything like that. Something that, a sound that is just something not coming from nature that's loud and uncomfortable. You know, pick anything. You know, screeching cars, loud music, and a place where you're out in the wilderness.
Yes. What's your favorite food indulgence?
Wow. Favorite food indulgence. I love carbs. So pizzas, French bread. Oh my God. French bread with hot out of the oven with melted butter on it. There you go.
That's a good thing. So we talked about a lot of things, and you said the phrase lost arts, and there's probably more than one, but there is a lost arts book, which is getting into vinegars and mustards and ketchups and some of the other, so that's the food side, but also some of the other just skills that our grandparents had, which we seem to have lost. Us city folk.
Well, for me too, I don't sew. I don't know how to sew. And, you know, we talked about people coming together in a community, combine your skills and talents. You don't need to do everything, but diversify amongst your friends. I have a, a neighbor down in my community who lives downtown in Colville, and she is a beekeeper. She makes mustard, brought me some of that. I give them elk meat when they run low. And, you know, trade what you have, trade your wares. This is what we were talking about, again, avoiding the restrictions from government limitations on what we can and cannot do. You know, I get my honey from her. I provide my neighbors and friends with eggs as well. So we all have something to contribute. And she's the one that's going to show me again how to make these purses. So that's another lost art, is making clothing and purses and bags from animal hides, making baskets. You can make baskets with pine needles. There are so many of these amazing skills. Can you start a fire with what's around you using just friction? These are all things that are lost arts that could actually save your life if you were ever in serious trouble.
Well, starting a fire is, yes, that is truly a lost art. I think the big letter people have made the need for that almost gone. But when the butane's gone, now what do you do?
Well, exactly.
All right. Do you have any, well, I know you do, which websites or social media, how can people find and follow you?
Well, I am on Facebook, Suzanne Sherman. I have a news page, Suzanne Sherman's The Wasatch Report. I have a live radio show that I do. We try and do it 4 or 5 times a week. And that is on the Cerberus, Cerberus Radio Network. We're on SoundCloud. We're about to get on the other platforms as well. And I have a website, Suzanne C. Sherman. So it's Suzanne C. Sherman.com. On there, you will find my blogs that focus on a lot of food stuff and canning, but I get into some of the red flag laws and other issues as well. And then there's a page that shows my published articles, mainly from the 10th Amendment Center, the Abbeville Institute, and the American Conservative. There's a SoundCloud bar link on there. So everything you need to know about me, you can find right there.
So we got a lot of ways to get a hold of you.
Yes.
Well, have we covered what you needed to say? Because I know canning and processing is easy to start, but like every other craft, there is a learning curve to going from basics to going to better. And do we need to just do better as another show, or is there something we need to cover about that?
You know, I think we could do another show, but just to wrap it up, you know, do your research before you start. Don't just get the stuff and think you're going to wing it. Ball Blue Book has a guide to preserving. There are great stuff, great sources online. In fact, I learned one from a homesteading site. It was a YouTube video. I'll share the link with you and you can put it up if you want. Okay. I watched this not only several times before I even started the pressure canning, but I had it playing and I'd pause it through every single step so I could follow. You know, a lot of generations, one or two ahead of ours, gave this up. So I didn't have a mom to teach me this because she didn't do it. Oh, that's just too much work. We can buy our food. So come around full cycle. If you're doing this in preparedness for an emergency, learn this before times are tough. You don't want to be, you know, under the stress of a harmful, of a situation that is very unpleasant, and try and learn a skill like this. And it is a skill. It's an art form. It's a craft. And if you get it wrong, it could be very, very detrimental.
Yeah, no, don't get it wrong. Well, when I was between 8th and 9th grade, we moved from a decent-sized town in northern Michigan to a teeny town in northern Michigan, and on 15 acres of land. And so we started 2 gardens, the small one and the big one. And between the two of them, we got more green beans and wax beans and tomatoes and corn and popcorn and rutabagas that I can tell you. I don't just like, oh my gosh. So much. So we put, my mom canned, but did a lot of just freeze, blanch and shock and put in the freezer in Ziploc bags, freezer jams. This was the early 80s. So post Carter recession, my dad was a realtor. It was tough. So growing your own food was a reasonable option to making sure you fed these kids.
You know, something else is cool I was thinking of as you're mentioning this. There, if you see somebody that has a tree that is a prolific producer and they're not harvesting it, offer to them, hey, can we harvest your apples, peaches, whatever, pears, and I will can some and give you part of it. you're not going to eat these, you won't get to them, and these will last you quite some time through the winter. So offer to do that for somebody as well. You know, that way you don't have to always rely on what's on sale in a store. If you have that resource available to you, by all means, take advantage of it.
Well, that's a good point. And depending on where you live, I know here in my town, some of the medians have fruit-bearing trees. And there's a little teeny tiny plum that people around here, they go crazy for. They'll stop and they'll pick it clean. And there's also not too far from here, wild blackberries. And people will stop their cars with buckets to go and pick these wild blackberries. Now, blackberries, boy, do those things have some thorns, but
worth
it. And if they just, you know, if it's ripe, it will just release itself like a raspberry. It just falls off that little nub.
Yep.
Man, oh man, you've never had a blackberry from the store taste like a blackberry picked 5 seconds ago from when it's absolutely perfectly ripe. It's worth finding, but wear long sleeves.
Wouldn't it be amazing if you could see in towns and cities, wherever it's possible, in these community parks, to set aside some space for trees, for fruit-bearing bushes, for things like that that people can just gather. Maybe it's utopian to assume that that would ever happen. But, you know, if enough people did it, enough places, eventually people would settle in and not be complete gluttons and greedy. And it would be just so commonplace. You can just pick an apple as you're walking down the road.
What a lovely vision.
Right? I'm not always a negative Nelly like I am on my show. This is so much more nice and pleasant than bashing government like I do on my own network.
Well, there's so much of that in so many places, and I'm not really qualified to do that. I'm learning about it, but really, I let the people who are better at it do that and not focus on what I know, and this is what I know.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite topics. So like I said, when you wanted to have a podcast and combine the two, I said, sign me up.
Well, here you are. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate that.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you, Dan.
You're very welcome. Have a good afternoon. Well, let's see. Just now. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, all right, folks, that's going to do it. Suzanne's contact links will be on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/69. We talked a lot about lost arts. Cooking is one of those which is particularly significant to me, but you heard Suzanne mention that she doesn't sew. Sewing and quilting and hide tanning are some of the skills, and they are skills, that are lost. Ken Albala, the food historian who talked about fruitcake, has a book I'll link to on the show notes page called The Lost Arts of Hearth and Home. It's not a book for living off the grid, but it is a book for people interested in learning some skills, developing roots with the kids, and building traditions. And ironically, it's available as a Kindle version. Life in 2020. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcatcher. Check out the Cerberus Radio Network at the link and leave a rating and review. And I will see you next week. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.
You know, another topic that I really like is organizing a food pantry and how you have different elements, for instance, freeze-dried, dehydrated stocks, ability to make stock like with powder, where you can make what you like and what people are going to eat in your family. And that way you can, you know, you're not just stuck with freeze-dried lasagna for everybody. You know, you can make a soup or a stew if you want to put mushrooms or peas or celery, whatever. You have all these different ingredients. If you look on my website, there is a picture. I think it's called the Recalcitrant Prepper. I think I sent you that.
Yes.
And that's an example of the diversification of your supplies you can have to always have something that somebody will like.
Well, I have a 13-year-old who we've termed her a flexitarian. She decided she wanted to be a vegetarian, but that came with one big problem, that she's not particularly fond of vegetables.
Well, she'll never be fat.
Well, well, she's so she's somehow she won the gene lottery and she will never be fat.
Oh, well, good for her.
The other one, the almost 8-year-old, is a bit more brave, but they're not as adventuresome in their taste bud daringness as I wish they would be. And I guess I don't think at 8 I was particularly bold and daring either.
Nor
so
was
I can't falter too much. But the cook part of me says, what do you mean you don't want to have this weird, you know, whatever it is?
I don't think so, I tried guacamole till I was in my 20s.
They both, you know, they're a funny color, but it turns out they both like avocados.
Yep.
Just the other day, the little one decided she likes grits. Actually, it was polenta because it wasn't white. But so she's growing. She's getting a better palate, and I appreciate that. But, you know, it's going to take a few more years before I have, if I can have things that are really fun and interesting. But, and I don't do any dehydrating or drying. I've never had a space. Those machines look like they take up a lot of space on the counter.
I keep mine in my pantry. That's something else we can talk about too.
I had a pantry.
Yeah, mine's pretty nice. I was really pleased with that. And, you know, when I use my wood stove and my propane fire heater here, I don't need to keep my furnace going. So that's where also unfortunately, the furnace is in my pantry. But I'm able to not use it even in the dead of winter. And so it stays nice and cold and dark in there. There are no windows.
Nice.
Yeah.